Nothing I sign today in any way diminishes or relaxes the environmental protections that are necessary.
The Interior Secretary wants to review development plans for ANWR and the NPRA. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, May 31st. Good evening, I'm Zachariah Hughes. Also tonight, for the first time since the 1970s, a brown bear makes an appearance on Douglas Island, and it didn't end well.
The bear actually turned to face him, and the homeowner felt like the bear was, you know, imminently going to come to him.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com.
At Alaska Pacific University, students are surrounded by beauty, distinguished faculty, and independent-minded creative students pursuing higher education. AlaskaPacific.edu, moving life forward with APU. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke today ordered new studies on the oil and gas potential of federal land on the North Slope, including in the coastal plain of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Zinke made the announcement at an oil and gas industry conference in Anchorage, marking a significant departure from the Obama administration's approach to resource development in Alaska.
So the president has declared, and thank you, Donald J. Trump, that the war on North American energy is now over.
The order also sets in motion a review of the management plan for the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska, with changes aimed at providing more land for oil and gas leasing. Zinke was flanked by Alaskan political leaders when he signed the order, including Governor Bill Walker, Senator Lisa Murkowski, and Congressman Don Young. During a press conference following the announcement, Zinke told reporters that the federal government plans on partnering with the oil and gas industry to assess the Arctic Refuge's oil potential. The last assessment was done in 1998. Zinke claimed the order doesn't loosen environmental protections on the North Slope.
Nothing I sign today in any way diminishes or relaxes the environmental protections that are necessary. And we understand that it's a sensitive area up there. We understand that people have made their living up there as assistants for generations and will in generations to come.
But Lois Epstein with the Wilderness Society in Anchorage said drilling isn't allowed in certain parts of the National Petroleum Reserve for a reason.
From our perspective, given how valuable the lands are that are off limits, there's no reason we should be opening up those areas because we have plenty of less sensitive places to be drilling.
Any move to allow drilling in the Arctic Refuge must go through Congress, and multiple attempts to do so in the past 30 years have been unsuccessful. Zinke did not make clear whether the reassessment would require work on the ground. Drilling opponents say that would require congressional approval, too. The Alaska Highway's 75th anniversary is this year, and organizers of those celebrations plan to include tributes to African American soldiers who helped carve the road out of rugged wilderness. On Tuesday, a room full of people at the Greater Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce meeting got to meet one of them. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Leonard Larkins Jr. was a skinny 21-year-old buck private from Louisiana when he arrived in Skagway in May 1942, along with about 1,200 other black soldiers with the Army's segregated 93rd Engineer Regiment. They joined more than 10,000 U.S. soldiers who hacked their way through wilderness to build a 1,500-mile overland supply route to help defend Alaska from attack by Japan.
The 93rd worked on the road until it was completed in October 1942, and then they had the pleasure of spending the winter in interior Alaska in tents.
State Transportation Department spokeswoman Meadow Bailey introduced Larkins in a talk she gave on the Alaska Highway's 75th anniversary during Tuesday's chamber meeting at the Carlson Center.
So they worked on the road until it was complete, and then they were sent to the Aleutian Islands because of that threat from the Japanese. And Leonard remained in the Aleutian Islands for the rest of World War II.
Historians say despite harsh treatment and lack of equipment, the 3,500 or so black soldiers in four segregated Army units excelled in their work on the highway, a project some say rivaled the Panama Canal.
According to historian Douglas Brinkley, the Alaska Highway was not only the greatest engineering feat of the Second World War, it was also a triumph over racism.
But Bailey says the black soldiers' role in the project and contributions to desegregating the military remained an historical footnote until recent years, when prominent national leaders such as former Senator Ted Stevens and former Secretary of State Colin Powell began to insist the soldiers be given their due.
And the achievements of these soldiers set the stage for the desegregation of the armed forces in 1948 and thus earned the Alaska Highway that distinguished nickname of being the road to civil rights.
After the meeting, Larkins told reporters he didn't have any idea he'd be working on such a historically significant project. The soft-spoken 97-year-old veteran says he was earning a living by cutting sugarcane for $5 a ton, and he joined the Army to get better pay.
At that time, about $20 a month.
Larkins says after he got out of the Army, he worked at a U.S. Public Health Service hospital in New Orleans until he retired. And like a lot of veterans, he didn't really talk too much about his Army service, according to his son, Kirby, who, along with two other brothers, accompanied their father on his return trip to Alaska.
He told me, I didn't talk to y'all much about that because I tried to put that behind me because it was so rough.
But Kirby Larkins says his dad's been sharing more memories about the highway project over the past year since he was visited and interviewed by a couple of authors who are writing a book about the project. The Larkinses will travel to Delta Junction later this week to take part in an Alaska Highway 75th anniversary celebration Saturday at Fort Greeley, and they'll travel to Anchorage next week for more commemorative events to be held there. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
A homeowner shot and killed a brown bear on Douglas Island last week, the first brown bear documented on the island in more than 40 years. Alaska Fish and Game's regional conservation supervisor, Ryan Scott, says sightings of brown bears are often reported on Douglas Island, but there's been no proof until now.
Over the years, we've had reports of bears swimming around, being sighted in the water adjacent to Douglas, and, you know, some other anecdotal information that, you know, folks see a bear and they believe it is a brown bear, but we've never been able to confirm it.
Authorities didn't name the man who reported he heard a racket outside his home at about 6:30 a.m. May 25th near Mile 5 of North Douglas Highway.
The homeowner went out to scare the bear away, which is, you know, a normal thing for Juno. And instead of responding like we would normally expect, running away essentially, the bear actually turned to face him, and the homeowner felt like the bear was, you know, imminently going to come to him, and he dispatched the animal.
The homeowner reported the shooting shortly afterward. Alaska wildlife troopers investigated the killing of the male, which reportedly weighed more than 700 pounds. The shooting was ruled justified.
The wildlife troopers did visit the site and talked to the homeowner and looked around a little bit. And, you know, it looked like the home was well kept. There were no noticeable attractants, you know, things like that. So it's a little bit of a head scratcher as to why the bear was as agitated as it was.
The last confirmed brown bear on Douglas Island was killed by a hunter in 1974. AT&T provided its Nome customers with a 4G network at the beginning of this month after years of preparation. Despite the improved coverage, more local support for AT&T customers won't be included in the upgrade. According to Sean Ushman, AT&T's Director of External Affairs for Alaska, the company's been investing more than $150 million in network upgrades throughout the state between 2014 and 2016. Through the use of existing infrastructure, a 4G network was established in Nome without building a separate AT&T tower. Ushman says the 4G project involved AT&T employees from multiple Alaska locations, as well as several contractors.
This was a big job for us. You know, it's going to be a game changer, we think, for Nome when the customers see the increased data speeds and get to experience that, you know, real time. We hope it's happening right now. And we really look forward to hearing from the customers and what those experiences are.
Some citizens in Nome have already reported issues with their phones since 4G was turned on, such as more frequently dropped calls or bad connections between them and whomever else is on the other line. Ushman says customers can call 611 from their cell phone or a national customer support number with any issues.
Again, this is the same call center that handles calls nationwide for AT&T, so we're comfortable with the level of support that they're going to be able to provide. We think that the customers in Nome are going to be pleased with the experience that they have calling into those numbers.
According to Ushman, AT&T does not release information about the number of customers it covers in a given region, so it's unknown how many people have AT&T in the services in Nome. Regardless, Ushman wrote in an email that AT&T will not bring in additional staff to the community, as the company can monitor the performance of its network remotely. Currently, a small team of AT&T representatives is visiting with its local partners in Nome. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Yukon-Kuskokwim area animal lovers are looking for more vets to travel to local villages.
They just need to enjoy helping people and like animals and be good at collecting data.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you're a K-12 teacher, consider the University of Alaska Southeast Juneau campus for Summer in the Rainforest continuing education courses. Two sessions offered, Basic and Beyond Arts Institute, July 24th through 29th, and Indigenous Arts Institute, July 30th through August 4th. Stipends, scholarships, and on-campus housing are available. Learn more at uas.alaska.edu/summerrain. This message is sponsored by UAS.
State officials want Alaskans to spend a little bit more money on products grown in state. To do that, the Department of Natural Resources is trying to get more food with the certified Alaska Grown brand out in front of shoppers. Arthur Keyes directs the state's Division of Agriculture, which is a new campaign called Five for Five.
We're asking all Alaskans to purchase $5 a week for 5 months at their grocery store. If every Alaskan were to take this challenge, we would put tens of millions of dollars back into the local economy.
The division is partnering with 40 grocery stores across the state to put Alaska-grown products on their shelves. That includes mainstays of Alaska farming like carrots and other vegetables, but also locally grown flowers, as well as more protein options like beef and pork. Keyes, who is himself a farmer, sees the initiative as a way of bolstering Alaska's agricultural sector by raising consumer awareness to ultimately drive market demand.
And I would just say I want to change how people look at food and how people look at agriculture in Alaska. I think people are unaware of how good it is here.
There's also a longer-term goal of building back some of the state's food security. As Alaskans have become more dependent on imported supplies over the last couple decades, people are putting away less food in their homes, and communities have become more reliant on planes and ships making regular deliveries. Keyes says a stronger local agriculture sector is one way of boosting resilience in case of a major crisis.
If things got very dire and the supply chain was broken for, let's say, a month, people would absolutely know. There would be no doubt that that we were in a very bad situation.
The Alaska Grown program started in 1986 to promote locally grown agricultural products. The Five for Five initiative starts tomorrow on June 1st. Sitka has been involved with the National Flood Insurance Program since 1981. That qualifies homeowners for flood insurance at the discretion of their lender, so long as the city maps out which areas are prone to flooding. With the appeal period for Sitka's new maps now closed, both the city and a handful of citizens are contesting newly drawn flood lines. KCAW's Emily Kwong has more.
Over the past 5 years, FEMA and the state have been updating the flood insurance maps, or FIRMs, along Indian River, Swan Lake, and 32 miles of city-owned coastline. The revised maps, which are still in draft form, incorporate LIDAR data collected in 2014. Property owners or lessees were then given 90 days to dispute the boundaries of the newly drawn flood zones. On May 23rd, Building Inspector Chris Duguay told the Sitka Assembly why taking part in the National Flood Insurance Program is still a good idea for Sitka.
Affordable flood insurance, loans are available for development from HUD, EPA, and SBA, all federally based. Federal disaster assistance can be provided to repair flood damage.
But the maps need some tweaking. He said the city is trying to lower flood lines along Cotleon Street and near Swan Lake. They've supplied FEMA with information about an outflow culvert there.
So it looks like we can possibly get some headway there in terms of adjusting where a number of other properties have been impacted in that zone, particularly east of Swan Lake.
The city wasn't as successful, he added, in convincing FEMA to change flood lines along Alice Loop. The new maps raise the base flood elevation, which represents where there's a 1% annual risk of flooding, by a foot and a half. Half a dozen Sitkins have also appealed, including Carrie Malin and Matt Donahoe. Their house on Galinkin Island is built above the 15-foot flood zone, but when they got it refinanced in 2013, FEMA said otherwise. Here's Malin.
They went with the topography maps rather than the actual visual maps, the photo maps. So they insisted that our house was in the ocean when it actually was on a rock. So I had to hire a survey to get a certificate of elevation, and that proved that we were on a rock and we were out of the flood zone.
That certificate qualified them for a Letter of Map Amendment, or LOMA. They thought they were in the clear, but that all changed with this latest version of the map.
They put us back into the flood zone and ignored our certificate of elevation. So I'm appealing right now.
Donahoe is outraged, too. Not just about appealing for a second time, but about the ramifications for Sitka's tax base.
When you get put in a flood zone, your property is devalued. Who knows how much?
They're not the only ones frustrated by the city's continued participation in the program. The Hames Corporation discovered that a corner of C-Mart was in the flood zone a few years ago. Their private insurance did not meet federal requirements, and they went through the appeal process, too. In an email to KCAW, COO Max Rule described FEMA's determination of flood zones as, quote, highly detrimental to future development. He added, quote, flood insurance can be prohibitively expensive in many cases that prevents reasonable growth and development in these coastal areas. It should be of concern to everyone. A concern, and for Malin, illogical. She doubts a flood will happen the way FEMA predicts it will.
Why do people here in Sitka have to pay FEMA for flood insurance when everybody knows we're not going to flood? And if we did get a tsunami, the big one, the scary one, it's going to be a lot more than the property that are just in the flood zone.
After all appeals are submitted, FEMA will process the comments and hold a risk map workshop in the spring of 2018. At that point, the Assembly will decide whether or not to adopt the flood maps and continue taking part in the National Flood Insurance Program. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Kwong.
The municipality of Anchorage is getting a $300,000 grant to help clean up distressed properties. The money is part of the Environmental Protection Agency's Brownsfields Assessment Grants Program, which aims to redevelop properties that are unoccupied or underused. In Anchorage, that means 8 to 10 sites will be analyzed to see if any environmental contamination has occurred and potentially draft a cleanup plan. Nicole Jones-Vogel manages land for the city's real estate department, which is helping administer the grant. She says decisions about which properties will be selected for improvements are going to be determined by the city's long-term infrastructure plans focused on areas served by major roadways and greenbelt trails.
The vision is to spur development, economic growth, and get the limited parcels that we have redeveloped and used in accordance with the adopted plans and the 2040 land use plan map and any other district or neighborhood plans.
The money won't actually be put towards cleanup efforts. Instead, the aim is to figure out whether or not there's been contamination, potentially removing the cleanup liability from would-be developers. Jones-Vogel and other city employees will work with partners in community groups and nonprofits as part of a planning committee to pick the sites.
So when we originally started talking about going after this grant opportunity, we were looking at places like Mountain View, Fairview, downtown, and identifying some of those underutilized, vacant, sort of blighted parcels.
Jones-Vogel expects the Brownsfields money could start coming in before the end of December as part of the three-year grant program.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Older Persons Action Group publishes Senior Voice, Alaska's only statewide publication for seniors, and is an excellent source of information for families and caregivers. SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG. Boating accidents happen, even to experienced boaters and on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make those you care about promise to be rescue ready by always wearing a life jacket when in an open boat or on deck. attaching the engine cutoff device when underway, and carrying emergency communication and distress signaling devices on their person. Visit pledgetolive.org for more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
The Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta has more dogs than it can care for. A veterinarian travels to Bethel once a month, but no such service exists in the villages. Unvaccinated and uncared for stray dogs threaten a community's well-being. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur reports how two organizations have teamed up to work with Delta communities to fix the issue.
2 weeks ago, Neposkiak decided it needed to reduce its stray dog population. So it did what many communities in the Delta do. The city offered a bounty, $20 per dog.
How many dogs were killed?
Maybe three.
Valerie Kaganik is the Neposkiak city clerk. She says it's hard to find people to participate. People don't like shooting dogs. Many don't collect their bounties. But they agree, loose dogs are a problem.
They open trash bags and let it scatter all over. And they steal food that we put away in our porch.
Subsistence food. The dogs also hurt people. Over the past decade, there were nearly 1,000 reported dog bites in the YK Delta, according to the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. More than half the victims were children under 10 years old. In the worst cases, children died. For the past 5 years, volunteer veterinarians have tried to address that issue by traveling rural Alaska offering basic vet services like spays, neuters, and vaccinations. This year, for the first time, the vets at Alaska Native Rural Veterinary Incorporated are teaming up with the Humane Society to work with three Delta communities to find solutions to their stray dog problems. The groups are visiting Gweethluk today, and Neposkiak and Napakiak on Thursday.
We want everyone to show up. Everyone's invited.
Angie Fitch with Rural Veterinary is organizing the meetings. She says to attend, head to the bingo hall with your stories and ideas.
Which will help us determine the best way to address lack of veterinary care.
Using this information, the groups will return three times this year to offer spays, neuters, and vaccinations to these communities. They'll also offer a doghouse building project, where the group gets donated wood and works with students in the schools to build doghouses.
So they learn carpentry skills, but also learn how to do something good for the community, and then the dogs will get new dog houses also.
The groups will hire one person from each community to help organize and run the visits.
They just need to enjoy helping people and like animals and be good at collecting data, because they'll have to get all the names of the families and the dogs and keep track of the shot record.
The goal is to use the program in the three communities as a pilot project to improve the lives of people and dogs across rural Alaska. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
The Rasmussen Foundation has recognized Unalaska's Gert Svarny as its Distinguished Artist of 2017. The award comes with a $40,000 grant, so the 87-year-old sculptor can continue developing her craft. KUCB's Laura Craigle has more.
In Gert Svarny's living room, tucked safely between a cushy armchair and a window looking out on the beach, sits one of her most recent sculptures.
Her name is Little Feather. And Inunungan is Aksam Anangukthayulu.
Little Feather is a young girl carved from blue-gray soapstone. She's wearing a traditional Inunungan dress trimmed with deep red ochre, and her hair is tied back in a long braid.
She's carrying a bag of ivory fish. She's saying, Mama, Mama, we're going to eat tonight.
The little girl and her fish are in good company here in Svarny's home, surrounded by all kinds of artwork. Finely woven grass baskets that fit in the palm of your hand, expressive wooden masks that depict hunters hard at work, and long-billed visors that celebrate the style of traditional Aleutian kayakers, warding the sun and spray from their eyes.
I think my inspiration comes from my people, because they're in my thoughts all the time.
But Svarny hasn't always translated those thoughts into creative endeavors.
So you got to art later in life.
I was 50, 51 or 52, somewhere in there.
Svarni says art wasn't on her agenda growing up in Unalaska in the 1930s. She spent her childhood outside, exploring the islands with her three brothers and three sisters.
We always tried to get away from Mom because she'd always make us do chores.
Life changed when Svarni was 12 years old. It was World War II, and the Anungan people were forced to evacuate their region. Her family was interned in southeast Alaska, except for her father, who wasn't Anungan and had to stay behind. Svarni doesn't talk so much about that time in her life.
Had good times and bad times. Always homesick.
When she eventually returned to Unalaska, Svarni had a husband and four daughters. They moved into the same house she grew up in, and one day, the art came to her.
I found some bones on the beach and decided to see if I could do anything with them.
Svarni sat down at the kitchen table with a melon baller and an X-Acto knife. She shaped one bone into a mask and the other into a small figure.
Had you ever taken the class, or did you just...
Never.
Just tried it?
I just tried it.
More than that, she loved it. She loved handling the materials, she loved bringing her ideas to life, and she loved the way sculpting brightened her mood on a bad day. But Svarni says that doesn't mean she felt confident in her work, not right away.
There's many times I have doubted myself, of course, like many people do in their profession, but I think, are you an artist? Can you call yourself an artist?
It's been almost 40 years since Svarni shaped those first pieces of bone, and she's come to think of herself as a sculptor.
But I've been thinking lately, boy, those rocks are getting heavy. Maybe I should start painting.
All jokes aside, Svarni says she's found her identity as an artist. Now she wants to help other Unungan creatives do the same.
I've always thought that so many of our people are artistically inclined, but sometimes life gets in the way and they never pursue, you know, what they want to do, like me until I was 50.
Svarni teaches art to students at Unalaska's cultural camp Kanayu, and she's brought up her own children and grandchildren with a love for the arts.
My granddaughter Larissa and I were talking, and we were saying that we had so many ideas that we wanted to do. And I said, Larissa, I will never finish my IDs because I'll die before I finish my the things that I want to get done.
But she's not stopping anytime soon. In fact, Svarni says this time of her life may just be her most creative.
I love doing it. When I'm working, I'm happy.
In Unalaska, I'm Laura Craigle.
That is all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage, Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Jacob Resnick in Juneau, Davis Hovey in Nome, Emily Kwong in Sitka, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, and Laura Craigle in Unalaska. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Sean Dugan is our editor and producer. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I am Zachariah Hughes. Have a great night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Alaska Job Corps Center offers training to young people 16 to 24 years old interested in completing their education or starting a career and who meet income eligibility. On-the-job experience is provided in all the training programs from accounting services to security and protective services. Tweet hashtag careersbeginhere to learn more. This message is sponsored by Alaska Job Corps Center, Chugach Education Services, Inc.
The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.